We believe that videos, images, words, and sounds have the absolute power to inform, inspire, and entertain. We are united under the virtues of safety and knowledge. We are a training community of learners and teachers who encourage and energize each other to achieve greatness. We are pilots, videographers, photographers, freelancers, business owners, enthusiasts, experts, and apprentices. We are creators. We are the Drone U.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another epic episode of Ask Drone U. My name is Paul.
And I'm Rob, and you're listening to episode number 298. As always, guys, we thank you and gals for spending a few minutes of your day with us.
We absolutely do. And guess what, Rob? I've got a great subject for you. It's one you love to talk about.
Oh my gosh, Paul. All I can say is this horse is a bloody pulp.
Have you beaten the horse too much, Rob?
Somebody has.
Are we talking about the drone legalities horse?
Yes.
I didn't say it. The Trojan horse?
You know what? We're still getting a lot of questions about it, and so I think it bears more discussion, and that's why we're here.
Well, I think what it bears is clarity because here's what's going on, guys. People are emailing me, they're calling me, they're writing messages to Rob. And we're hearing about this more and more often, which is, hey, I'm trying to fly for recreational purposes. I'm closer than 5 miles. I'm like right inside, or I'm 3.5 miles away. I call air traffic control and they tell me no.
Right.
I didn't know that I needed permission. And the answer is you don't need permission.
Yeah, because we've been telling everybody from day one, really, that they're just needing to notify.
Correct.
Right?
That which is correct. But why there is this gray area and why even members of the FAA, in fact, Rob, your friend who's in air traffic control, didn't even know about the Section 333.
Nope.
What was that, a couple months ago?
It was probably 3 or 4 months ago.
And he works with the FAA.
He does work. I mean, he manages a bunch of controllers, actually.
Which is very cool. But that being said, there's a lot of confusion just between everyone on, well, can they fly close to the airport? Can they not fly? And the answer is complicated because you always hear one of two things. You only need to notify. Here's what you say. Here's what you do. And then the other thing is, well, you're an aircraft. You can't fly in Class B airspace. You can't fly in Class C airspace unless you have a transponder or a two-way radio, you know? And the thing is that simply the guidance, so AC 9157 and AC 9157A are both guidance documents, and AC 9157 is what the AMA has been using as their basis of guidance since the early 80s. But what that says versus what actual law says is two different things. Under the circumstance that drones are defined as aircraft. So let me say that again. What the law says and what the guidance says are two different things if drones are defined as aircraft. Now, normally these have been looked at two very separate things, and that line has really been muddy. So we decided to bring on John Rupert to explain this. Why is it a big deal? Why is there this gray area? But also, he's going to give you guys an update on the Section 333 exemptions. Unless you were living in La La Land, there was an update to the Section 333 exemptions that does affect all people who are filing and who are applying.
So it's a quick rundown of that change. I know he'll go into more detail.
Quick rundown. It's about your aircraft and whether you have to file amendments for each aircraft or not.
Okay.
So, but also, he's going to give us an update on the Taylor case, you know, John Taylor v. FAA,
right,
which is all about whether registration is legal or not. He's going to give us an update on that because they're waiting days for a decision, maybe even this week. We don't know.
And there's a lot of significance writing within that case.
Huge significance, because if the FAA kind of gets stopped by saying, okay, you ram this rule down the throats of consumers and you didn't do it right and it's going to get thrown out, it's really going to change the track of drone law for this year, because right now the FAA has that task force on micro UAS. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot that's coming down the pipe and people are really saying a lot right now, when it comes to micro UAS. Some people are saying, oh, we're going to see NPRM this year. Some people are saying we're going to see micro UAS this year. Some people are saying NPRM 107 will happen after Homeland vets it out. Some people are saying that micro UAS will happen next year.
It's time to start a pool.
It really is.
Seriously. I mean, who knows what's actually going
to
happen?
Yeah, we should actually take bets on that. That's a legal way to make money off of drones, right? We're just going to bet on the regulation outcome.
Is that legal?
We could find out.
Maybe we should ask John that question.
That would be a good question. I feel like, you know, I finally watched through and through The Big Short, and I feel like when he's explaining CDOs, like, mm-hmm. I feel like this is our CDO of the drone market.
Seriously.
If you don't know what a CDO is...
Watch The Big Short.
Seriously, you're going to need to watch that movie if you want to understand what's going on in this economy. So he gives us a huge breakdown, and I say, let's just get into it. Let's not waste anyone's time. Let's not drag our feet. Rob, what do you say?
Let's jump right in.
Here we go. Here is the man. John, good to hear from you, buddy. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, John. You are a wealth of information, and you know, I love what you're doing for the community. I will say I love your quote from Newsweek. I read this Newsweek article on you, and it said, and I quote from John Rupert, "I'm going to blow the drone registry up." I love that quote, John. That was great.
There was a lot of other things that I said in that interview, and it, for some reason, that reporter made that kind of sound like an action movie or something. It's like coming to a summer, you know, a theater this summer, you know, near
this
you.
Saturday night.
Yeah, it's like, I was like, whoa. Like, you didn't even mention anything about me talking about the safety aspects, the long-term consequences of this case, how it's going to polarize the industry, how people, because there was a quote that I said in there that it looks like the FAA is like kind of like dictators, basically ramming this down people's throats, saying, hey, you better obey us or you're going to go to jail. That was in context of a larger point that I was making. That wasn't my statement, but the view of the individuals in the industry. So that wasn't my point. My point was the overall story that I was telling was that, hey, with you doing this, everybody's going to look at the APA arguments we brought up and also the Section 336 arguments. And Congress told the FAA that you have to obey these rules. And so therefore, by them not obeying the law that is over them, they look like tyrants and that people feel justified in disobeying what the FAA says. And so instead of going to the FAA to ask them, hey, how can I operate safely, legally? They're running away going, hey, you guys are actually the tyrants. You guys are the bad guys, not us. We're not the rebels. You are. And it's going to polarize the industry. And I'm like, that's the real sad part about this case, because there's no dialogue really going on. There's much more schism and polarization going on, going similar to back what we had under the relationship of the industry and the FAA when the whole Perker case was going down. It was very anti-FAA. Things started to kind of heal for a little while, and then now it's like, boom, right back at it again.
Yeah, I think the media is also taking that stance as well. And for everyone who's not sure which case John is talking about, he's talking about the John Taylor case, the lawsuit against the FAA for registration, which you are a huge part of, Mr. Rupert, or I just want to differentiate the two Johns. There seem to be a lot of Johns around here. But before we go really into the big macroeconomic effects of what the John Taylor case is going to do in regards to the industry, which I agree with you, just like I was saying, you know, the news is taking that side too. I don't know if you saw the recent articles and stuff about the FAA is overblowing the risk of drones to aircraft. Did you see that?
I saw it, but I have not had a chance to actually read it.
Oh, I didn't read it. I don't expect you to. So anyway, again, we all know you've been working on the Taylor case. I want to get into that in detail later, but I really want to kind of go back into showing people why we are in this situation to begin with, why we have this gray area, what some people believe is this, some people believe is this. You know, I recently saw that video of a guy who mentioned you and said, if you, you know, want to operate drones legally, I kind of want to make our own video, but with the caveat of saying, in the eyes of the FAA, if you want to fly illegally, because it comes back to this whole gray area, which is where we are, and how if drones are defined as aircraft, we have this entire set of laws that we have to follow, but yet the FAA isn't defining them as aircraft in other instances. And I give the example of the David Boggs, who's a Drone U member, and the William Meredith case, where Meredith shot the drone out of the sky. Well, hey, if the drone is defined as an aircraft, isn't that a federal offense to shoot an aircraft out of the sky? So I think it's really important for people to understand this. And as you know, John, last week we had a message on Facebook that was asking about a scenario. He was trying to fly in Class Bravo airspace. He was a recreational hobbyist pilot, and he was calling the tower to give them notification of his flights, and they said they would not give him permission. And he said, well, I don't need permission. I'm trying to give you notification. And he asked me, how can I give notification if they won't even listen to me? Now, John, if I understand it correctly, AC-9157A, which replaced 9157, which is the guidance documentation for recreational or hobby pilots, mandates that there's a notification to local ATC for recreational flights when within a certain location of the airport. Is that right?
Right. Well, they advise that, and that's based upon Section 336. There's five elements, and one of them in there is if you're operating near an airport, you must notify the tower if it's a towered airport, or the manager if it's just, you know, manager-run non-towered airport. But that creates some problems, because that Section 336 portion is regarding the prohibition on the FAA from creating any rules or regulations governing that, those guys, not actually this is how you do it. So that's one clarification that needs to be done there. So the FAA kind of just said, this is the public law, and then said, this is the law. And it's like, wait a second here. This is the law for you, as told by Congress to the FAA specifically. But even if an individual were to operate that way, so as they just go out and do mere notification to a tower, if they can find that phone number, I mean, good luck. I mean, the quick way, if you guys do want to find a number, go to the airport facility directory, the AFD. There's a phone number in there for the manager, but good luck trying to get that after 5 p.m. because what happens at 4:59?
Oh, it's 3:59, John. Come on.
Ring. Ring. It goes on forever. You're never going to get anywhere. So if you are going to do operations near a towered airport, you're going to want to find out who, you're going to want to find that phone number, call over there before you actually do this. Because especially, this was annoying when I was getting off work sometimes in the past, is when you'd get off work at like 5, you go, oh, I'm going to go out and do some recreational flying at this location. But then you're like, well, if you make the phone call, you're goofed. You have to pre-load this and actually have that conversation. So if you need to actually contact the tower, because they're going to act, the managers are going to act as a gatekeeper and not let you do the tower phone number, because they don't want everyone blowing up their phones. And there are some, there are a few towers out there. Specifically, there's one over in Tampa. They actually allowed a portal where you could actually log online and then do it that way to do the notification. So I thought that was a clever way to, yeah, to kind of decrease the amount of workload that these guys are having to deal with. And so let's say you even comply with this advisory guidance stuff. Well, the problem is that you're going to get charged with breaking the regulations, not the guidance documents, okay? Because the guidance documents don't have the force of law behind them. Regulations do.
So just to take it back a step, what you're saying is that if we follow the guidance documents that say, you know, we only need to give notification, that potentially causes a problem, because the actual law or the force of law says that, hey, you have to listen to air traffic control no matter what. But that is under the circumstance that, again, drones are defined as aircraft. So long story short, we have guidance that says one thing, whereas the law says something different. Is that correct?
Exactly. So for Class Delta or Charlie airports, you are required to establish two-way radio contact. For Class Bravo airports like Miami, LAX, Atlanta, O'Hare, you are going to have to actually be specifically cleared. So you're going to have to hear your call sign. you're cleared to enter Bravo airspace. Otherwise, you're to remain out. So you're going to be violating the regulations. And then most people say, well, has anyone ever been prosecuted for violating these regulations? And I go, oh, two examples. David Zabludowski flying in Midtown. He was down in Manhattan. He was cited for violating the Class B requirement, that you must have clearance prior to operating in Class B airspace. And then you also have the Skypan case as well. So you have a commercial as well as a recreational individual both being cited for violating that regulation.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, so if they're being cited for the violation, though, is the Department of Justice, which is kind of the the enforcement arm of the FAA, have they done anything against Skypan or David Z?
Well, the jurisdictional, okay, DOJ and FAA's relationship primarily is going to be based upon what you're being charged with. So it, you know, depends on what your dollar amount is or if there's criminal stuff involved. So if it's over $50,000 criminal, it's going to go to the DOJ, Department of Justice. They're going to be enforcing that. If it's below that and non-criminal, it's going to stay with the FAA for enforcement. That's how it's being handled right now. And with the Taylor case, since it's that challenge, that's actually being handled not by the FAA but by the DOJ, which are pretty much acting, if you will, as the attorneys for the FAA.
Interesting. Okay. So with the Skypan case, so that's well over 50,000. So it would DOJ would be the one enforcing the action. Is that correct?
Correct. And to date, I do not know of anything going on with that case, if it has been filed or not. I haven't been paying too close attention to in the court documents, actually, just in the docket, to see if anything's moving forward or not with them actually going after them.
But you're unaware of anything being filed against Skypan by the DOJ?
Correct.
I feel like I'm interviewing you on the stand. Mr. Rupret, were you at the Tampa Bay airport on Wednesday eating ice cream with your girlfriend?
I can't handle the truth.
That is
actually right. That would be probably the best way to say that to the German community. It's like, you can't handle the truth, you know?
I can handle the truth. all right, so let me ask you this question. So DOJ is not going after him, or you don't know of them going after him.
Make a point on that is...
I was going to say the same thing, because here we have an interesting scenario, right? We have the FAA saying, you've done bad. DOJ hasn't done anything. When we're trying to figure out here, if drones are defined as aircraft, well, then wouldn't both of these people get in trouble? And it seems like this case is kind of going to be one of those deciding factors.
Potentially, but, you know... I don't know what their exact strategy is behind the scenes. Do they want to hold out and then negotiate? Plus, I don't fully know. I can't. It's hard to prove the evidence of that absence of evidence right now when I haven't fully looked. And with this drone community, I think the big problem is everybody looks to the Facebook groups to publish stuff and their friends and the news sites. I mean, that's pretty much what happens. Yeah, right. As soon as you hear something, what do? Facebook group. And there's like 20 comments. And then someone's like, oh my gosh, I hate the FAA, blah, blah, blah. You're stupid, blah, blah. Right? And that's how it always works.
Oh, dude, on Reddit. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, the problem that happens is that's just what's actually been publicized. There's a lot of things that actually never make it to the news, which is kind of interesting. So, I mean, I know of things here and then I'm like, oh, that never made it to the news. I wonder why. So I would want everybody to remember this statement. The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, okay? Just because you hear nothing does not mean there is nothing going on. So everyone needs to realize that I got word just yesterday that there was some more investigations brewing regarding the FAA, regarding some drone operators. So
what did you hear?
I don't know how much I can tell you, but anyways, there's some stuff going on. So that's why there's stuff brewing and I know about it, but nobody in the industry is talking about it, or there's nothing on the internet going on about it. So I would just want to reiterate to everybody, the absence of evidence is not the evidence you can rely on to not, you know, not get in trouble, right? Of absence, okay?
See,
so
where
don't
you're
be
going
relying
with this.
On the lack of news articles that the FAA is not going after people to somehow say, oh, we're fine, you know. So we don't fully know what's going on out there, because the FAA has actually kept a lot of these enforcement actions, the news regarding them, pretty tight to the chest. I mean, we have there was a presentation I was at about a year ago where the FAA announced that there was at least 20 enforcement actions that were going on. And there was at least two of those I can point to and say that it was the White House lawn guy. There was one guy that was flying near a helicopter up in Alaska. And the third one, I guess, would be the Skypan case. One of them is involving a suspension of a pilot's license. But that was over a year ago, and so I think that there's some more stuff brewing here. The FAA is very cold and calculated how they're doing stuff. They're going to take in the info and hold it and keep watching you, and that's kind of how they operate. So remember, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Good to know, good to know. It seems kind of like the FAA has, like you said, kept things close to the chest, but they've kind of also gone down their own path when it seems to regulating UAS or regulating drones. I mean, we're seeing all these bills in Congress, in the Senate. You know, Congress even said in 2012, you know, FAA, you can't promulgate any rules against hobby drones, or excuse me, model aircraft. I said that wrong. You may not promulgate any rules against model aircraft. And we saw the registration, which is the case that you are working on now, fighting and suing the FAA on registration. How will that case affect, say, enforcement actions, but also the perception of the public and how we move forward in drone law? Because I think it's so pivotal, because if the FAA doesn't care, you know, kind of what Congress is saying, and they're doing their own thing, I mean, what would we see? And in the other instance, if you get a decision with Taylor that kind of pumps the brakes on the FAA, what are we going to see? And as far as I know, from what you've told me, you're expecting to hear something in the next few days, if not next week.
Right, exactly. So just at the onset, I would like to say that Taylor and I are working on the case together. There are some other attorneys that have been very gracious with their time in helping us behind the scenes. I don't know if I can mention their names or not, but there are people that are helping out in the community. I don't know whether or not that they want their name public or not. So I just want to thank those people if they are listening. But there are some long-term consequences to this case, because if the FAA is kept in check regarding this APA issue, the Administrative Procedures Act, which requires the FAA to issue a regulation via the notice and you put a notice out in the Federal Register, then it's commented upon, and then later on they actually publish the final rule. Now,
and you're talking about registration.
Right, exactly. Okay. And so the only way to get around that is called the good cause exception. There's three ways to get around that. And so the FAA pretty much is evoking the good cause exception for – it's like an emergency, saying this is so rapid and so quick and it's taking off that we have good cause to get around the notice and comment. So that's one part. And the second part is also the 336 restriction on the FAA from creating any rule or regulation governing model aircraft. And so – they're going to have to overcome both of those arguments. And so the big problem with the 336 thing that they face is that if the district court of – this is the Federal District Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, guys, okay? A Circuit Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So this is right below the United States Supreme Court. Before, when we had the Perker case, that was at the administrative law judge level in the National Transportation and Safety Board. Then it was appealed up to the full board. And after that, Perker could have gone to the district court or to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So this level, this field that we're playing at here is the, if you will, it's pretty much like the JV Supreme Court. What they say has long-term lasting effects for administrative law and a lot of other federal appeals courts in other circuits, like the Ninth Circuit over in the California area and stuff. A lot of these places all are going to defer to the administrative courts. So there's really long-lasting consequences from this case. If the FAA is told 336 protects people that are falling in this category. This rule, part the interim final rule creating Part 48 registry, was a violation, then it's going to get thrown out. And that's going to cause the FAA to stop and think about creating any rules or regulations governing model aircraft under 336. Additionally, okay, the FAA might try to argue, well, just with the model aircraft part, let's try to maybe carve it out or something. And we can keep it for commercial aircraft, the people operating under the 333s. Because most people probably listening to this might not be recreational operators. They're just commercial. And they're wondering, like, well, what does that Taylor case have to do with us? You know, aren't we looking forward in March 31st? Part 48 is going to open up and we can register our aircraft that way so we can comply with registration. Oh, and by the way, there were some changes as of the 7th of last week that came out, amendments. The amendments were coming out for the 333, and it started saying that you could comply with registration via Part 47, our port, or Part 48, while the whole long time before the 7th, it was only Part 47. So they just started updating that recently, which will be interesting if that all gets thrown out by a judge, then everyone's back to the Part 47 paper-based route. And, okay, so that's the 336 issue, model aircraft. There's long-term consequences there for the model aircraft community, FPV racing, anything in there. The Administrative Procedures Act, if the FAA is found to be violating those guys, then that set of laws, then you're going to have the rest of it thrown out for that as it applies to the unmanned aircraft, commercial and non-commercial, that are not in the model aircraft category. That's going to get FAA thinking, wow, we need to be very, very careful if we're going to go forward with the micro rule and creating that, because if we just got our stuff chucked out, then if you want a micro rule to last and not get chucked out again, then we need to be very, very careful and follow the law correctly so it can survive judicial scrutiny and review.
Gotcha. Very, very interesting. So, wow, where do I go? There's so many different routes I can go off of what you said. As far as some of the updates for the 333, there was another update for 333 operators in the last week or two, wasn't there?
Yeah, exactly. So the individuals that were that filed amendments. Okay, so backing it up, everyone would go get your exemption, and then you get upset because you're like, great, I want to fly the Phantom 3 when all I have is the Phantom 2. So you petition for an amendment to add on more aircraft. Well, this ballooned the docket for the 333s because everybody's just asking for more and more aircraft. So what happened, I was on the 7th of last week, the FAA gave out almost, if you will, these like blanket aircraft type of amendments. So they said, okay, your proof for everything on this list over here, which is a total of like, I think it's like 1,120 aircraft on that list. So that's going to put an end to all this petitioning for adding aircraft going on, which was ballooning and bogging down the processing time. So that's beneficial for the guys with pending exemptions because things are going to start to speed up. But that's only for people amending going forward. So if you have already got a 333 in the past, it does not retroactively apply to you in the past. It only applies to people that are going forward with amendments. And I suspect that they're also going to apply that to individuals that are petitioning for the basic 333 to begin with, so as to, you know, future prevent any of those things going forward.
Gotcha. So, gosh, there's so much going on here. The Taylor case, Skypan, changing up the 333s, changing up commercial registration online, how all of this could be affected by the John Taylor case. So let me ask you this. The one thing I didn't hear from you is what you're expecting to hear soon. There's supposed to be an update on the John Taylor case soon, right?
Well, exactly. There was a motion for summary disposition that was filed in the case. And basically what that is it's saying, hey, court, there's nothing really to talk about here any further. We don't need to go to a full briefing on the merits of this case. Look at Part 48 and look at Section 336 that says you cannot create any regulation governing model aircraft. This is a simple one. Part 48 regulation, don't create any regulation. That's basically what it's asking. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's so simple. It's like there is no nuanced little secret things we need to fully kind of explain here. It's like it's pretty simple. They created a regulation. Congress said, don't create a regulation. Judge, please rule. quickly. And it's kind of like a fast track to getting an answer on the that. So that's what was filed on the Part 48. And that was filed a couple weeks ago. And we still have not heard anything yet.
When do you expect to hear?
Any day now, but that was any day now a couple weeks ago, and it's still any day now, and we're kind of just like, we're kind of waiting.
I don't know.
Like, it should be coming out. Well, I don't know.
So let me ask you this. If, let's say you get a decision the next week, John Taylor case, they strike Part 48, John Taylor case is a success. Do you see the task force still moving forward with micro UAS? And would you see Part 107 coming to fruition this year?
Okay, so the micro rule, if the summary disposition is granted, that was only at one point of that. There's three cases going on, by the way, with the Taylor case. So, I mean, there's just so many little onion, there's onion layers. You're just peeling them off. So there, one issue is the Part 48 issue. And that's the one we asked for summary disposition. And that's specifically regarding the model aircraft registration. So going forward, the guys in the ARC are going to be very careful looking in light of what just came down so as to not create any rules, regulations governing model aircraft, right, that are in the micro rule, 4.4 pounds or lower. So that's going to educate them. And then what was the other point, the second part?
NPRM 107. Okay. And I say that because of this. In the last week, I heard that from a pretty prestigious person that they spoke with the head of the UAS division of the FAA. And that person said, as of a couple weeks ago in DC, that Homeland Security was still kind of vetting out the Part 107. It was the last holdup. They were pending approval, but expected to have it soon so that they could put out 107 by June. Now, I don't know if put out means, hey, you guys can all fly your drones commercially now, or if that means, you know, on June 1st, there's actually a system to take a test and get certified as a drone pilot per the NPRM 107.
As of actually this morning, I just checked, and we have still not had the FAA submit the proposed regulations to the DOT for review. Okay, so the whole entire steps that the steps that need to come down the pike here that the FAA needs to do, you have FAA to the Department of Transportation for review. They review it, sign off. Then it goes to the Office of Management and Budget. They sign off. There's also going to be Office of Information Regulatory Affairs. It's going to be do a stakeholder analysis. It's going to ask everybody for their input on what they think is going on. There's going to be multiple analysis done. And then it gets published as a final rule. So if people are saying it's coming out in June, all of that has to take place before June. And as of this morning, I just checked, and it has not even left the FAA to the DOT for review.
Are you saying that there wouldn't be enough time between now and June to actually get all those things done?
It's very unlikely. However, with the drone registration rules that the FAA did, I mean, they cranked those things out really quickly. But they're also being challenged as being illegally created.
Gotcha.
So remember, the Taylor situation is also going to educate them on the 107 setup, going, hey, well, we better watch out if this thing's going to get too broad, or if we're going to like skip the APA notice and comment, proper rulemaking, and all these things that are required to do, Regulatory Flexibility Act, multiple executive orders. They're going to have to make sure they do everything properly. Also, keep in mind, if you're getting your pilot's license right now, one benefit to that is that you're going to get a TSA background check. So yeah, when you go in under 107 and apply, so you're going to take your computer-based exam, you're going to send it off. It's like your TSA background check generally lasts around like 2 years if you're a pilot. So they might be trying to coordinate that so that way your background check's already done. So instead of waiting for 7 to 8 weeks or more like everyone else, they might just get it and go, oh, he's already cleared, mail him back the already done one, because we already checked him out, because you just got your sport license the other day, right? So that's an interesting benefit to going and getting your pilot's license. If you want to add the 107 later on, you'll get it quicker than everyone else. Furthermore, you also think about this, the test, I don't even know if it's been fully created yet. Some of the people I'm talking to behind the scenes, the FAA is working on that. So even if 107 does come out, what's the test that you're taking, you know? And then there's going to be a surge and a rush to it. And it's going to be interesting because then you're going to have like a 333 backlog kind of thing going on with the 107,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So let me ask you this question, because this has been one that's been asked time and time again by listeners and by people in the Drone U community and whatnot. Do you think there's still adequate value to having a 333 exemption or applying for one now, even though it seems like a lot of people in the community believe that the 107 will come out by June, even though you're skeptical, I'm skeptical. And I think a lot of the people in the community are skeptical. But what would you say to those people?
I think that they make a good point because they're trying to figure out who to trust, because you have the FAA that's just very, very adamant on saying it's coming out by June. And then looking at the current wait times for the exemptions that are taking much more long, you know, the process, that they're like, well, by the time I get my 333, I could go for 107. Well, that's presuming that the FAA is telling you everything that's true. That's the big if. And the FAA has a really, really bad track record for the last so many years of not meeting their deadlines. So it seems very foolish to plan your business around some legal forecast dates and stuff by an agency that has, I mean, a really, really high record of not getting their dates accurate. Okay, so I mean, I've gone through the records and I've seen many, many, many times they're like, hey, this is the new proposed date. This is the proposed date. I mean, they're just busting them left and right perpetually. And furthermore, once it leaves the FAA to the DOT, it's out of the FAA's hands at that point. They're going to have to get DOT and get them to cooperate going fast with it. Plus, in addition to that, OMB, Office Management Budget, Office Information Regulatory Affairs, these are agencies outside the FAA. They're going to have to move very fast with it. So even if the FAA cranks this out tomorrow, they're like, yo, get my Red Bull, guys. We're going to crank this out tonight, you know? Doing like, right? It's like a final exam, like coming down the pike. You're like, yeah, we're going to do this, right? So if they crank it out tomorrow and they send it over to the DOT, DOT is just like, oh, we might get around to it. Maybe next week. And then it's like, okay, and we wait. So there's a lot of what ifs here and a lot of, you know, problems on the horizon that will come down the pike for you if you just keep waiting it out. I mean, I remember all these conversations that people were having with me
a year ago.
Yeah, I'm like the Booker. Remember the Booker amendment? And then there was like Schumer, and then Feinstein passed something, and everybody's
and
like,
the
"Oh,
September 31st deadline too."
Oh yeah. It's everybody, and then it's like a telephone game gets played, and it's funny how it moves around the industry. How it's like, I'll get phone calls where people call me up. Hey, I heard it's coming out in June. And then I'll get another phone call like 2 weeks later. It's like, oh, I heard it's coming out in April. And then it's like, oh, it's coming out in late February, early March. Well, that was busted. No, that one was one of the good ones where it was, I was told by somebody, and it's always somebody, like somebody. And then it's in DC from the FAA. You know, Was this like the security guard, or is this somebody that actually knows what's going on? What, who are you talking to? Because you have to actually, and furthermore, just because you're in the FAA doesn't mean you actually know how the regulatory process works.
Yeah.
And that you somehow know exactly everyone down the, you know, all the multiple steps work. So I think it's a really bad way to do business just holding out like this with the 333s, saying it's going to come down the pike. It's going to come down the pike. Well, it hasn't been coming down the pike for a really long time. I hope it does come down the pike. It'll be the best for the community to commercially operate, but it doesn't look like it. It could, but it doesn't look like that based upon my knowledge of the regulatory system. The FAA could try to do something illegal, which would be interesting, because then who would challenge it from the drone community? Probably nobody. But then you might have the ALPA, you know, Airline Pilots Association, Helicopters Association or something. They might want to challenge it because they tend to be more anti-drone. And so then we could get regulations created too quickly, and then they get shot down, and then you're back to the 333. It just seems like a better business model to plan for something that you can count on, as opposed to what ifs and friends and people giving you little tips here and there, and then Facebook, and oh my goodness, the Facebook, like, I heard something from somebody. And then everyone wants to believe it. I know you want to believe it, but it's just rumors.
It's like why they say conspiracy theories work, because people innately want to believe the thing, like what you're being told. It's a really interesting point. And I really wanted, in the beginning of the podcast, I wanted people to understand the difference between guidance and the laws and how drones are defined as aircraft or if they're not and all that, because it gives people an idea of the fundamental gray area. And it gives people an idea that even though you think that we may have progressed in some ways, we're still where we are just a year ago, and not, and really not much has changed as far as the environment in which we operate. But John, I just want to say, you know, thank you again for coming on the podcast, giving everyone an update. Is there anything else that you want to tell the community while you have the chance?
Well, I also want to say is that one downside to waiting to jump in is that depending on what sector you are working in, especially cinematography, if you don't have a 3-3-3, you're going to have a hard time playing, you know, in that sector. And furthermore, your competitors are jumping in and taking over that business. However, the complete opposite spectrum of cinematography is going to be like the real estate market, where it's just grab a Phantom and go out and fly, you know, nobody cares whatsoever. But I think the real estate market's the one you don't ever want to look at, because that's like, that's where it's like the commoditization of the profession. Because then realtors are going to start realizing more and more like, well, I could just cut you out of the loop and buy myself the Phantom, whatever, 5 or 6, whatever comes out in a couple months from now, right? Jump on some editing software or Fiverr, right? And then just do an okay job.
Fiverr.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying. And then so the market's going to drop there. So you might want to start looking at other areas to get a better business model. Look at your specific sector. You know, are you doing precision ag? Are you doing mapping? Are you doing cinematography? Yeah. Because then there's going to be interesting things going on there. Like even with cinematography, you're going to have different types of breakdowns in the price points of what's going on. I mean, you have the big time players that are going to be lifting Reds, Alexas and stuff. Mm-hmm. Then you have like this mid-tier, I'm doing an S1000 GH4 kind of setup. And then you have like the P3 or P4 with an Inspire kind of setup.
I've
and then-
never seen a Phantom on a set before, John. I don't know if it goes that low.
You see, I know that you would say that, but, and I thought the same thing when I was asked. I was like, wait, why would you want a fan? And then it was like, oh, because we actually need the actor on the TV set flying a Phantom and like make him look like a Phantom. So you're basically flying the Phantom. I was like, oh, cause I was like, why? I'm like, dude, you fly Reds and you're asking me to put like a Phantom. I'm like, why would you, you know? And I was like, oh, okay. That makes a lot of sense now. Yeah. So that those are kind of the three different models there. And then you have like over there with the mapping, you know, do you have a surveyor's license? Are you going to be doing something in there? Are you going to be doing construction? Do you have any construction background and understanding what's going on? So you want to start analyzing your industry and then, you know, start moving into that, you know, and understanding it that way. Just don't even say anything about real estate. That is just, that doesn't even make sense. That's like wedding photography, right? Everybody and their dogs on Craigslist, they got a, you know, some DSLR kit and is now offering, you know, photo packages for whatever. Right?
Yeah, I actually, you know, I brought that up to, we just did an interview with Eric Chang on the Phantom 4 and I asked him, I said, do you think the Phantom 4 is going to be like DSLRs and weddings? And he was like, well, no, not really. I think they are because I've seen people flying Phantoms with no experience of flying inside over people during a reception. I think it is happening. And then, you know, I've also been preaching a lot to people that, you know, you guys really need to master flight, because I see a lot of 333 operators who they have the paperwork down, they've got the system down, but their flying skills could really use some help. And people have been saying, well, you know, is the 333 bubble going to burst if they do something with micro UAS? Because you're going to have, again, the DSLR with wedding scenario playing out. I mean, do you see something like that happening?
Right. I see the commoditization of this sector happening much more. And post-production can only make worse or bad, you know, super bad, bad. Okay. Right. It's like China, you know, you can only make a shot, darker, but you can never make it lighter. It's the same thing. Like, you got some bad shots. You can't do too much post-production for your Jell-O, man.
Yeah.
So that warp stabilization stuff does some funky stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're like, what is wrong with your, what's happening on there in your photo? What was going on? You know? So, there is going to be a commoditization, and I would say that one benefit to jumping into the 333s right now is that you can actually start trying to market and trying to get relationships built and operate more in the open, because people are getting much more risk averse to operating with people that they believe or that the FAA says are operating illegally. Yeah. Okay, I just want to make two points on that. Is just that one, there are some the companies, when they're vetting people, they're going to be trying to find the most competent operator. So they're going to be looking at the background checks, everything, and, you know, who can do the best job so as to prevent any possible accidents. And in addition to that, proper vetting to find an individual who is compliant with what the FAA says. And if you really think of what the FAA says, it's really like safety standards. Okay, just get rid of the word regulation, just call it safety standards. If you are not complying with what their safety standards say and there's an accident, then that's a great setup to then sue that company that hired that drone operator for negligent hiring and say, hey, you could have vetted them. Did you check their 333? Did you check their pilot's license? Was it registered? Did you check any of their stuff, their MPTOM, if they had closed set? Did they follow their MPTOM? And if proper vetting is going to prevent a much more expensive type of litigation defense if there is an accident of some sort down the pike. So companies are starting to become much more aware of that to prevent that, because there is going to be a need to defend that because you dropped below the standard, the operator did, that the FAA set. And then they're going to have to prove that they were operating safely. Maybe the product was bad. The DJI product went haywire, and it was really them. But there's going to be a lot more fighting on that standpoint. Second point is you can start making money now and then looking to 333s in the future that are currently not granted now, but under 107, you don't have any hope, and start looking more as this is like a stepping stone, getting your feet wet to then transition into non-Part 107 Section 333 exemptions like night, moving vehicle, 55-pound and heavier, 500-foot and higher operations. So you don't have to be worrying about the commoditization that's going to happen in 107.
That's a good point. Very good point. You brought up a question I wanted to ask, but it is escaping my mind at the moment. Oh, yes, I remember. So one of the things that I learned recently is that, you know, once you apply for your 333, which as some of you know, because you've gotten your 333s with John, is that John does help people obtain their 333s. And people ask me all the time, well, you know, why would you get a lawyer? And something I just learned very recently is that once you get your 333 and once you get your MPTOM, and this is why I've been bugging Rob about our MPTOM and sending that over to you, John, is because there's a next point to meet. And a lot of people never get to that next point, which is the standard operating procedures, that document that you come up with. Isn't that correct?
Well, with the MPTOM is pretty much an SOP for on-set operations. And so dealing with an attorney that specializes in that area, you're going to be able to have access to that and understand what it means to comply with that and try to get access to, you know, or petition for exemptions that have not been approved already, such as like night moving vehicle and stuff like that. You have that option. And then also, just backing it away a second, the having an attorney is valuable for the purposes of having a frank and honest discussion regarding the legalities of a certain type of operation or not. So for instance, if, you know, Paul says, hey man, I just shot some dude. Well, that statement is protected by, well, what are you looking around like? No, I've been seeing you guys on beady eyes. You're like, yeah, I'm gonna get me a new Phantom 4 by robbing that dude. Anyway, so that conversation is going to be completely privileged and is protected from being introduced at your prosecution. If you deal with a consultant, the problem there is that the FAA or the Department of Justice or prosecutors can petition them, or not petition, but subpoena them to then testify against you or even produce documents ratting you out. And so you set yourself up for not being able to have a full, frank, and honest conversation. Like, hey, John, I flew in Class B airspace. What can happen? Please give me those type of discussions. I mean, I've had discussions with people that are, you know, I'm getting investigated. I had the FAA do XYZ or the cop stopped me. What do I do now? What's going to happen to me? And if you just deal with a poser consultant that knows nothing about criminal defense or FAA enforcement actions, you're setting yourself up for, you know, some problems there.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All right, one last thing. I know I've said that probably two or three times now. Recently, we were working with a police agency who had received the policy documentation that the FAA had sent out saying, if you suspect unauthorized unmanned operations, you know, look for the registration number, should be here. And then that cop who was showing me that, he literally ripped it in my face and he said, let me ask you a question, Paul. If there's a bank robbery, is the local police taking care of it? It's a federal statute, a federal offense. Did the local police do anything? And he's like, maybe show up to secure until the FBI shows up, but that's a federal thing, so the FBI takes care of it. He goes, you know, with how busy we are, you know, he goes, no one is going to write the reports on whether people are, you know, breaking the quote-unquote law on drone registration. And so I want to ask you, you know, what are your thoughts in regards to that? And what are your thoughts? Because I know some areas are much more strict than others, meaning LA police are valiantly going after people for flying their drones. But, you know, here in the Southwest, most cops will tell you, hey, man, that's really cool. Don't fly over people and leave you alone. I mean, so there's this stark contrast. But in your mind, what do you think about all that?
I think it means that you need to do what's called pre-flight planning. Before you ever go into an area, you should definitely scout out what's going on, because New York City and that surrounding area and Southern California tend to be pretty hotbeds of activity. I have talked to people in those areas that have been arrested for flying their drones. So we have that is currently going on right now. I mean, the city of LA is, if you're flying your drone and you recreationally and you fall outside of some of their own guidance that differs from the FAA's, then they'll just arrest you. In addition to that, you also have commercial operators. If you don't have your 333 on you and you show it to them, because you're required to have that 333 on you and present it if they ask for it, then they can arrest you and you can be prosecuted under that. So it's all over the place right there. Friendly police officers and there are other ones that are just going around asking, hey, where's your papers? And then it's like, uh-oh. Another thing else to think we remember here is that if you're doing close-set cinematography, in addition to the whole need to be having a 333, just to kind of get some jobs, let's say you even just get some jobs and you don't have a 333, there's a problem there with when they hire the police officers to kind of close down the area. You know how they do like off-duty police officers to do security? Yeah. Everything. Yeah. Well, some of those police officers are pilots, and they know what's going on. That there's like I'd probably say 90-something% of the 333 guys out there don't have a pilot's license or anybody flying. So, you know, what happens if one of them comes over to you and is like, "Hey, let me see your 333. Oh, and by the way, let me see your pilot's license and ID." Oh, and then it's like, well, they're going to be able to figure out who you are real quickly because you just talked to the production company who hired you. And it's like,
So let me ask you that question, because it seems like 90% of the people who tout their 333 don't follow the rules. I mean, and a lot of people, you know, talking about earlier, you see a bunch of comments on Facebook. I posted something on Reddit about, you know, what we talked about last time, that the, you know, 90% of operators are breaking the law, because in order to fly closer than 500 feet to anything, you've got to have an MPTOM, which most don't have, and most are not licensed pilots. Are we going to see the FAA do anything about that? I mean, this is the argument that a lot of, you know, as the rebel crew, as I would call them on Reddit, this is why a lot of the guys think the 333 is just hypocritical and useless. And I understand the perception. I get it. I also understand the opposite perception. But that being said, there was even one guy on Reddit who said, I've been a licensed pilot for 30 years. I can fly my helicopter 200 feet from a house at, 300 miles an hour or 200 miles an hour. and I don't have to file a NOTAM for that, you know. There, it seems like people think that there's this broad overreaching bureaucracy with the 333, which has been a common theme. But another common theme that has evolved out of the last couple of years is that most people aren't even following the rules of the 333.
Right. Well, yeah, there it is very, very difficult to comply with all the restrictions in certain types of industries and operations. Once again, real estate one. I'm just like, don't use real estate. 'Cause that one's that's just this weird. I'm like, it has becomes very difficult. I mean, you can do it, but
I mean, even the guy who made that video, the extreme photography guy, and he was saying, I've got my MPTOM, I film real estate, and I have this barrier. Remember a shot of the barrier he had in front of the house. But it's like, yeah, but all of those other houses are non-participating as defined by the FAA. So how is that legal?
Oh, well, you can knock on the doors and just ask, you know, the owner, hey, I'm going to be flying my drone over here. Is that fine that I'm going to be flying within 500 feet of you? Okay, great. Yeah. So, you know, you do the Girl Scout cookie thing, knock on the doors, which is also a great opportunity, right? You know, drone operator, you know, and so you can also use that as a really good opportunity to advertise your services, you know?
Drone operator here.
Well, I mean,
to ask for permission to fly my drone. But I will you know, Legal Flyer is a great thing to get that permission, John, just
right.
So you know.
Right. Well, yeah. So when I say real estate, okay, it's not like real estate is like 100% impossible. It's difficult, okay?
Sure it sounds
can
like
be
it.
It can be done by people, especially if you have higher net worth type of houses that tend to have like, you know, 5 acres, stuff like that.
Ranches.
Where the realtor's going to get a pretty good commission, right? And so he can afford to pay you a fairly good amount of money to make sure everything's legit. So there are some operations that are perfectly fine, but a large amount of like urban, I'm just going based upon numbers of houses and stuff here, but there are places and stuff you can do that it would be legal, and you would be able to actually do it with your 333. And if you had closed set filming, then that allows you to do like virtual real estate walkthroughs with the realtor, who's, if you will, the actor, right?
Yeah.
And you can have maybe the owners of the house, right? And there's like the white picket fence, and there's like, you know, somebody's grilling a hot something like hot dogs, and there's like the Labrador retriever, and there's a kid playing frisbee. Well, if they're the owners, right? You could just say, hey, this is the MP2M, let's go follow it, blah, 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 blah. You operate under that, make them actors, you can film it, boom, bada bing, bada boom, you're good to go. It is workable, it's difficult. Okay.
So let me ask you this question. Have you heard, because I know you've heard of these enforcement actions, and I'll probably ask you again, we're not recording, but of these enforcement actions that you heard of, have you heard of the FAA going after anyone for not having a pilot's license? Are you hearing of them going after people for not having an MPTOM and flying closer than 500 feet to buildings or people?
Oh, okay. Well, the MPTOM setup is actually part of the waiver process developed back in the 80s, post Twilight Zone movie crash. So Motion Picture Association of America worked with the FAA to get a waiver around 91-119. And that's also, I believe that's one of the charges that Skypan, don't quote me on that exactly, but I believe that's also one of the ones they got cited with in addition to it.
Gotcha.
A bunch of others.
So the answer could very well be yes, but we won't really know until we get an answer from the Skypan case.
Oh, right. Well, let's see. We'll see what the DOJ says in addition, because the FAA proposed the fine. Now let's see what the DOJ, which of the regulations they decide to kind of pick up and go with.
Yes.
Or they pick up a bunch of them, you know?
Sounds like we're back to square one in limbo land. Anyway, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. We greatly appreciate it. If we want to read more of your recent updates, where can we go, John?
Oh, you can go to my blog at www.jruprechtlaw.com, and you can email me at jon@jruprechtlaw.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Now, I know that you answer some questions on Facebook, but not all of them. Guys, again, if you are a DroneU member, he is in the private community group if you have a question directed to him. If John has the time, he will definitely answer it for you. All right, John, that's going to do it for us today. And guys listening, thank you again. And John, thank you, sir. I greatly appreciate it.
And thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Anytime. Anytime.
So, Paul.
Yes.
What do you think?
Lots of information. John is so knowledgeable. Big surprise.
I don't think he sleeps. He just reads.
Seriously. But that being said, I love what he's doing for the industry. He's one of the few guys that is actually doing what he says he's doing. He is not only walking the walk, but he is talking the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, it's vice versa. But anyway, what I like is that he is he's doing a lot for the industry as a whole. And I think it'll be interesting because if... You know, the court comes out and says, FAA, you did not have the authority to come out with this rule the way that you did, and we are going to take it all back. You know, what happens to all of that data and information and registration, the registration information?
Yeah.
Because here's a side note, right? What if the FAA were to sell that information on all the drone pilots? Because, like, think about it. That's valuable, valuable information. That's a valuable list.
It is valuable information. Well, we've actually had people ask us, Paul, gosh, I registered, and it was before I heard you guys, and you guys were suggesting that I don't do it via Part 48. If I do it at all, I use 47. Can I take it back?
No.
So I wonder if the Taylor case goes in, we'll just call it the favor of dronies.
Yeah.
If there will be a mechanism for people to take it back, so to speak.
Well, I think, you know, if the court rules that that registration is in fact illegal and illegitimate, then there's not going to be any taking it back. It would have never existed. So
right.
Yeah, I know, right?
Bad chance.
But I think it's really important because, you know, this country is going through a time and era right now where people are really questioning how we come up with law, and we've got to maintain the way that we come up with law. It's so fundamentally important to who we are as a country and how we do things.
True.
Checks and balances is really important. That's why I'm excited to hear the outcome of this case. I think it will shed light on the future of drone law.
So here's my question.
Yes.
If they come back in favor of the FAA, essentially, what then? Are we going to move on?
You know,
are we going to let that horse lie?
You know, some might think that I'm sitting here saying if that were to happen, that would be the worst case scenario, that blah, blah, blah. I'm not sure that that is the case because... If the court decides that registration was in fact legal, which I don't believe is going to happen, like deep down, law speaking, I don't think it's going to happen.
Got it.
If it does happen, I think there actually may be some benefit to the drone community as a whole. It would be minuscule, but it would be a small benefit in the fact that the FAA would just keep pressing forward. They've got an aggressive agenda right now. Very aggressive agenda. But then again, I think it's 95% bad because it's setting a precedent for an agency to completely go around the way that we set the precedent for laws. And also, what does that say between the relationship of Congress and the FAA and the courts as a whole? If Congress says, don't do this, and then you do this thing, and then the court says they did this thing and they were in the right. So
yeah,
I think it's gonna be really, really interesting. I think it's gonna really showcase regulatory framework authority in this country.
Yeah. Well, so, we'll see what happens. Hopefully sooner rather than later.
Again, we're supposed to hear something very soon.
Yep.
That's why we wanted to come out with this podcast. Good news for Section 323 holders: you will be allowed to fly all aircraft, which is kind of cool. So very excited about that. You guys understand the gray area now. This really comes down to the fact of whether drones are defined as aircraft, which is very interesting because if they are defined as aircraft, then why isn't the FAA filing with the DOJ to go after people who shoot down drones? So it showcases that drones being defined as aircraft are not being treated equally in all places when being defined as aircraft.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, it shows the need for some categorization of types of aircraft to include a category for drones, but
yeah,
we'll see.
Just
if that
like
happens.
Lighter than air, just like, you know, powered parachutes, just like, gosh, there's so many examples.
Right, because I mean, clearly it is an aircraft of sorts, right?
Yeah,
it's not a ground craft or whatever you
it's
call
not
it.
Not a rover.
Not a rover. Not a boat.
You know what? I bet if you try to fly your bird upside down, she'll just stick to the walls, Rob, and you could just crawl along the walls.
Huh?
No, never mind. Don't try and do that. Anyway, guys, I hope this I hope this has cleared the air for you, because a lot of people are still giving me these questions like, what about this? What about this? What about this? Look, guys, you're going to hear two different answers unless you understand the fundamental problem. So I just want to make sure that that is as clear as it can be. Want to give you guys an update on the Taylor case and hopefully give you some hope. Remember how important it is to stay in touch with your representatives, to make them aware of the problems, senators, congressmen, and also of proposed solutions. So anyway, that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. Please give us a review. Please subscribe to the podcast. Please share it with someone who you know loves to fly drones. But that's going to do it for us today. My name is Paul.
I'm Rob.
This is Ask Drone You.